Inspector Beresford stood by the side of the road, looking down at the bodies of the two men in the roadside ditch below. One of the local detectives was just climbing back up the hill toward him. Beresford flashed his badge.
What do we have here?
Bodies were found by one of the patrol cars. Both male, both in the late 40s or so. No IDs in their wallets and nothing in their pockets either.
The officer pointed back up the embankment at an angle.
There's a pretty big blood stain on the road over there, which is how our guy knew to take a look. Seems like whoever did it killed them up there, then kicked the bodies over the side. They rolled down the hill and ended up where you see them now.
Beresford pictured it all in his mind and decided the other man was probably right.
Coroner been notified?
Came and went. We're just waiting on the wagon to come pick them up at this point.
You finished up down there, then? Mind if I take a look for myself?
Go right ahead.
The officer wandered back toward his patrol car to have a smoke. Beresford made his way down the embankment to where the bodies lay, Clements on his heels. He crouched down next to the first body and directed his flashlight beam over it. Right away, he noticed two things. The pockets of the man's pants were turned out, and the man's head rested at an unnatural angle. The first was probably a result of the work of the cop who'd just left, but the latter certainly wasn't. At least they wouldn't have to wait long for the cause of death to be determined. A broken neck was a broken neck, unless, of course, the injury occurred post-mortem. The coroner would certainly be able to tell them that, at least. He moved to the second man, while behind him, Clements began his own examination of the first. Two sets of eyes were always better than one. The second man was smaller than the first, though not by much. A massive bloodstain colored the front of the man's shirt, however. Beresford took a pen out of the pocket of his sports coat and used the tip to push back a piece of material that was covering something on his chest. Doing so allowed him to see the massive stab wound.
What the hell kind of blade would it take to do that?
He'd know soon enough. The autopsy would at least help him narrow it down. But still, it looked like the man had been stabbed with Excalibur, for heaven's sake.
Hey, you need to see this.
Beresford stepped back to the first body. Clements had done the same thing he had, pushing a piece of clothing aside to reveal what was underneath. But in this case, it had been the open collar of the first man's shirt. On the man's shoulder was the tattoo of a red hand, fingers held together, palm facing out. Both men recognized the mark. You couldn't work terrorism in the United Kingdom, particularly close to Ireland, and not do so. It signified the dead man had been a member of one of the last few remaining terrorist groups in Northern Ireland. A quick check revealed that the other man had the same tattoo in the same place.
I guess they needed CT after all.
Shaw was confident that the torque would soon be his. He was certain the problems Trevor Jackson was experiencing were only temporary. So he continued with his preparations for both the auction and what he planned for the torque after that. He'd already selected an appropriate recipient, so he moved on to the next piece of the puzzle, arranging the specific delivery method.
Yes, Perchenko will be fine.
Perchenko had a good supply of product and could be counted on to maintain the strictest level of security with regard to Shaw's operations. Of course, anything he told the Russian would be a complete fabrication. That way, if word of what he was up to surfaced somewhere, he'd know exactly where the story originated and could take the necessary measures to ensure that it never happened again. He would hate to kill the man, as he found the Russian and the materials he could lay his hands on rather useful so far, but he wouldn't hesitate to do so if it proved necessary. Shaw opened his safe and removed a military-grade scrambling device from inside. The scrambler had been taken off a patrol unit of the Royal Irish Regiment a year before. It was slightly dated, but it still worked quite well for his purposes. With it, both the location of the call and its contents would be untraceable. He plugged the scrambler into the telephone and waited for the two devices to shake hands with each other. When they were set, he dialed the Russian's number. Perchenko had once served on the outskirts of Chernobyl, and his scarred face and vocal cords were a constant reminder of how life can depend on the simplest of things, such as a shift in the wind at a critical moment.
Hello, my friend. I've decided that I'll take that consignment offer you made last week after all.
The price has gone up 10%. I have another interested buyer.
I was told it was an exclusive offer.
It was. No, it is not.
I should take my business elsewhere.
Go ahead. I will sell it to Gaddafi's followers for twice what you are offering.
Shaw knew he was not going to get the man to budge from his position. The Russian was useful, but he was also stubborn. Once he'd made up his mind to charge Shaw an extra 10%, he'd prefer not to make the deal at all if he didn't get what he was looking for. It would be best if he simply accepted the additional 10% penalty for not completing the deal a week earlier and take the package off the market. Who knew what a desperate Gaddafi might do?
All right. 4 million plus another 10% for your willingness to cut out the competition.
Done.
I will contact you in a day or two with delivery instructions.
I will be here.
It was almost noon by the time Anya awoke. She lay there in bed, blinking the fuzziness from her thoughts, and trying to get a handle on everything that had happened in the past 36 hours. Despite being shot at, knocked unconscious, dumped in a bog and left for dead, the deaths of her friends and colleagues caused her the most pain. At least the confrontation with the armed gunman in the Mercedes had shown whoever was behind this that trying to kill her wasn't going to be as easy as they thought. On the plus side of the equation, she was still alive and reasonably unscathed. But she still possessed the ancient necklace that seemed to be the root cause of this whole mess. She was going to need it in order to get to the bottom of things. It was clear she couldn't turn to the police for help. The gunman's presence on the team that had responded to her distress call made that evident enough. No, she was going to have to figure this one out on her own, it seemed. After a quick shower, she turned on the battered old television. The sound was down. As she dried her hair with a towel, she was startled to see her own face appear on the screen. But it was the headline below the picture, "Cable TV host missing, presumed dead," that really caught her eye. She dove for the volume knob.
As more officers are called in to deal with this horrific tragedy. Among the dead are Oxford professor Craig Stevens, as well as Paolo Novick, a visiting professor from the University of Turin. Noticeably absent is the body of renowned archaeologist Anya Creed, who is thought to have arrived on site just a few days before the devastating attack. Creed, who also serves as the co-host of the cable television program Chasing History's Monsters, has been missing in action before, most notably in the wake of the tsunami that devastated the Kanyakumari region of India early last year.
The image shifted back to the announcer.
As we stated earlier, authorities are uncertain as to Creed's whereabouts. Searchers are combing the woods and the boggy areas surrounding the dig site in the hope of finding some clue as to her condition. For now, let's go to our sister station in New York, WTXC, for a few words with the producer of Chasing History's Monsters, Doug Morrell.
The anchor desk was replaced by a live shot outside of the network studios in New York. The reporter shoved the microphone in front of Doug's face as he drew closer to the entrance.
What was Anya Creed doing in England, Mr. Morrell? Do you think she had any involvement in what happened at the site of the massacre?
Despite his relative youth, Doug was the consummate professional when dealing with the media. He smiled easily at the reporter.
The idea that Anya had anything to do with what happened at the site is simply preposterous. As I'm sure you'll realize, she was there on assignment for Chasing History's Monsters. The entire staff and I are praying that she's all right.
He turned and faced the camera directly.
And if she is, I'm sure she'll be in touch soon with answers to all of our questions.
Anya let out a breath she hadn't known she was holding. She'd been too tired to check in with Doug when she reached the hotel last night, but there was no reason to put it off any longer. Doing so would only give him more time to wreak potential havoc. Anya glanced at the clock. It was just after 1 London time, which made it around 8 a.m. in New York, so Doug was probably on his way into the office. She didn't have her BlackBerry or laptop anymore, so she couldn't simply text or email him. Nor did she want to call him directly from the hotel phone, as she had no idea who might be listening in, and didn't know how extensive the police investigation had gotten while she'd been out of touch for the past several hours.
Guess I better find a payphone.
Thankfully, it didn't take long. She found one outside the tube station just a couple of blocks down the street from her hotel and used her company-issued calling card to try and reach Doug's cell phone. When she couldn't reach him there or on his office line, she left a message on the latter.
Doug, it's Anya. I'm all right, but I'm gonna need your help getting to the bottom of this craziness. I'm calling from a payphone because my BlackBerry is busted. Until I can get a new one, you can't call me, so I'll plan on calling you back just before lunch instead. And that should be enough to keep him from doing anything crazy. At least I hope so.
Anya caught a cab over to a local shopping district and spent the next hour or so replacing some of the things she'd lost at the dig site. A surplus store offered up two pairs of cargo pants in her size, while a nearby fashion boutique gave her fresh t-shirts, socks, and underwear. She snagged a prepaid cell phone from a tobacco shop and activated it while standing on the sidewalk outside, feeling slightly less isolated once she'd done so. Her last stop was at an electronics shop, where she bought a second-hand laptop to replace the one she'd lost, and then requested that the files on her old hard drive, which she'd rescued from the dig site, be transferred to a DVD, so she could access them on the new one. The kid behind the counter wasn't thrilled with the idea of having to actually do some work, it seemed, for he winced at the request.
Yeah, you know, we're pretty busy in here today. It's gonna be a few hours before I can get to it.
Anya waved a 20-pound note in front of him.
How about half an hour instead?
The money disappeared in a flash, and the kid got to work. While she waited, Anya grabbed some lunch from a fish and chip shop down the street and used her new cell phone to call Doug.
Doug Morrell.
It's me.
Anya didn't want to identify herself in case anyone in the restaurant overheard her. Doug, however, wasn't paying attention, apparently.
Me who?
Me.
Look, me, I don't know who you are, but I'm waiting for an important call. You're just
Doug,
gonna have
if
to...
you don't shut up and listen to me, I'm gonna fly back to Brooklyn.
Anya! Why didn't you say it was you?
She used her free hand to rub her temples. Talking to Doug almost always gave her a headache.
Did you get my message earlier?
She could practically see him nodding.
Yeah. What the heck is going on over there?
There were only a couple of other patrons in the place, but Anya figured it was better to be safe than sorry.
Hang on a sec.
Anya wrapped up the remains of her meal in the newsprint it had come in, and then threw the trash into the bin by the door on her way out. Once on the street, she felt better about not being overheard.
Okay, listen up.
She gave Doug a quick rundown on the events of the past 2 days, including the appearance of the armed gunman at the dig site and their later attempt to run her off the road.
Gunman? That sucks.
Tell me about it.
We can't use gunmen in the show. Way too boring. Never mind, overdone. Bog mummies, on the other
Don't
hand.
Don't even start, Doug.
But surely you can see
Doug.
That...
Doug!
You know, you could be a little nicer to me sometimes. All I'm trying to do is help you with your career.
I don't need any help with my career. I want you to help me get out of this mess and find out who's behind it all.
Okay. What do you need?
Anya described both the torque and the tattoos she'd seen on the arms of the gunman as best she was able.
Use the research team and see if you can come up with any information on either of them, okay?
Yeah, okay. What do you want me to tell the police?
She didn't want him to tell them anything, but she knew that wasn't a realistic option. As her employer, they were probably already sniffing around him, waiting to see if he had any information on her whereabouts. She might not be a formal suspect yet, but she knew that status wouldn't last too long the minute they found out she was alive and well.
I don't care what you tell them. Stall them any way you can. I need some time to run down these leads so I have a better idea of what's going on.
Don't worry about it, Anya. I'll handle things on this end. Call me later. Maybe the research team will have something by then.
Doug! I wasn't finished. Oh, he always does that.
D.I. Beresford was in the midst of his lunch in the cramped little room that served as his office. It was the desk sergeant downstairs.
Talk.
Got a guy down here claiming he's got information for you about that Midlandston.
Beresford glanced at the half-eaten meal on his desk.
He looked legit.
Ever since the news broke the night before, the tip line had been flooded by hundreds of calls. Each and every one of them had to be investigated, no matter how unlikely or even ridiculous they might sound. Beresford couldn't afford to get sidetracked with wild goose chases, and he'd had his share of meetings with well-meaning but mistaken citizens, convinced that the neighbor they don't really care for down the street was up to no good.
Well, the guy's a priest.
From the tone of the man's voice, Beresford wasn't sure if that meant the sergeant felt the witness was completely trustworthy or exactly the opposite. Nor could he find a way to ask without insulting the man.
Send him up.
The detective cast a longing glance at the lunch he knew he'd never get the chance to finish. A few minutes later, a uniformed officer led a harried-looking young man into his office. He was of average height and build, with sandy hair cropped comfortably short, but not too much so, and he was wearing the official uniform of the Catholic Church, black clerical shirt and pants. Beresford rose to meet the priest.
Hello, Father. I'm Detective Beresford. Won't you sit down?
Thank you.
What can I do for you, Father,
Anderson. Father Gary Anderson.
Anderson frowned.
I've never done this kind of thing before.
Inspector Beresford smiled, trying to put the man at ease.
Well, why don't you just tell me what happened? The desk sergeant said you have some information about the events that occurred recently near Arkholm. Is that correct?
The priest nodded, opened his mouth to say something, and then changed his mind about whatever it was.
What if what I have to tell you can get me in trouble?
Beresford's expression didn't change, but his level of interest did. Perhaps this wasn't going to be the typically useless interview after all.
Do you mean with the diocese or with the law?
Anderson winced.
The law.
Well, that would depend on what happened and exactly which laws were broken. Would you like to have an attorney present before we go any further?
The question was one he didn't like asking, as the suggestion of having an attorney present often derailed a witness's level of cooperation. But it was one that had to be asked, if only to be sure everything that was said during the rest of the conversation could be used as evidence if it ever came to that. Anderson surprised him, however, by waving the suggestion aside.
No, that's all right. It's in God's hands at this point, anyway.
Beresford nodded. He didn't quite believe that himself, but he certainly wasn't going to argue with the man. If he didn't want a lawyer present, that was his business. He waited for the other man to continue.
I picked up a hitchhiker yesterday. I think it was the American that's gone missing, this Anya Creed woman.
Beresford wasn't surprised. He'd heard something similar, if not those exact words, at least half a dozen times already that morning. Never mind the 300-some-odd sighting reports that had come in over the anonymous tip line in the past 12 hours. People were seeing the missing television host everywhere.
Where were you when this happened, Father?
About 15 miles south of Arkholm, on the M6.
Beresford's interest perked a little. That was in the right place, at the right time, at least.
Did she introduce herself to you as Anya Creed?
Anderson shook his head.
No, she just said her name was Amy.
Can you describe her to me?
Anderson did so, noting the hazel eyes and the ponytail of dark hair. It was a good description, the kind with just enough details to make it believable, to make it seem that the priest had indeed seen someone who at least looked a lot like Creed. But Beresford wasn't quite convinced. After all, the woman's photograph had been featured in just about every major newspaper and popular magazine in the London area for at least the past 12 hours. Perhaps he'd just seen it there.
Sounds like it could be her, but then again, it sounds like it could be 100 other American tourists, too. Are you a fan of her show?
Me? Oh, heavens no. I don't watch that kind of thing.
So, why do you think it was her?
Well, it wasn't so much her as it was the two men in the other car trying to kill us.
He said it so matter-of-factly that for a moment Beresford wasn't certain if he'd heard him correctly. When he realized he had, he sat up straighter in his chair.
Someone tried to kill you?
I know, it sounds crazy, but I can't come up with any other explanation. Why else would they try to run us off the road?
Why else indeed, Beresford thought, his pulse pounding as his instincts told him they were about to get a break in the case.
Tell me what happened.
Anderson described how he'd seen a woman walking alone on the side of the road and how he'd stopped to see if she needed any help. She'd told him she'd had some trouble with her boyfriend and that the lout had kicked her out of the car. Anderson had offered to give her a lift back into the city as he was headed that way as well. Shortly after she'd gotten into the car, a dark-colored Mercedes raced up behind them and rammed the rear of his vehicle. By now, Beresford was taking notes, capturing his first impressions of the individual who'd entered Anderson's car. At the top of his list, he wrote, "Already being pursued." After that, he put who/why.
You're sure it was a Mercedes?
The hood ornament was clearly visible.
You said dark-colored. Can you be more specific?
I think it was black, though it might have been dark blue.
A license number?
The priest shook his head.
Sorry.
Look, you're doing fine, Father. Just relax. Keep going.
Anderson explained how Amy had used the hymnals he had in the back seat as makeshift weapons, forcing the other vehicle to keep its distance by throwing them at the windshield of the Mercedes. Stays calm under pressure, Beresford wrote.
That seemed to work for a time. They kept their distance, and I was starting to hope that we'd be okay if we could just find somewhere less isolated. I assume they wouldn't continue attacking us in front of witnesses, you know.
Beresford had been a police officer long enough to know that the presence of witnesses very rarely kept anyone from violence.
That's a reasonable assumption. Is that how you managed to escape? By finding someplace a bit more lively?
For the first time since sitting down, Anderson actually smiled, though it was still a sad, bitter smile.
Oh, no. That's when they started shooting at us.
Shooting at you?
Beresford was starting to feel like a broken record, dumbly repeating what was said to him, but as crazy as the story sounded, he found himself believing the young priest. What did he have to gain by lying, after all?
So, what did you do at that point?
Do? I didn't do anything, unless you count quaking in fear as an action. I was terrified. It was all I could do to hold the wheel steady as the maniac behind me tried to run me off the road while his partner in the passenger seat was firing a gun at my car.
But you obviously got away, so something must have happened to allow that, right?
You asked me what I did. I didn't do anything.
Beresford knew that they had arrived at that part of the story that had prompted the priest to ask about the possibility of prosecution. If he didn't want Anderson to clam up, he'd have to be careful.
So far, everything you've told me fits squarely into the category of self-defense. They attacked you on the road, and being afraid for your life, you defended yourself. Pretty cut and dry to me.
Anderson considered that for a moment, nodded as if he'd realized the wisdom of the detective's statement, and then continued. As Beresford listened closely, Anderson went on to describe how Amy had convinced him to let the other car catch up, and then at the last minute, he slammed on the brakes. He and his hitchhiking passenger had been prepared for it, all buckled up and expecting the collision, but the men in the Mercedes had not. The two vehicles collided with steel-shattering force, bringing them both to a shuddering halt.
That's when she pulled out a sword, climbed through the shattered rear window, and attacked the men in the Mercedes.
A sword? I thought you said you didn't have any weapons.
I didn't think we did. But suddenly, this woman is waving a sword that's longer than my arm and rushing off to do battle with the people who'd just been shooting at us moments before.
Beresford was about to ask where on earth she could have gotten a sword, but then realized he knew the answer already. If it was Anya Creed, and his gut was telling him that it was, then she had probably taken it from the dig site. Her possession of it might also explain why she was being pursued. If the simple fact that she was a potential witness to a multiple homicide, and therefore needed silencing, wasn't reason enough. The detective couldn't imagine what a group like the Red Hand Defenders would want with an Iron Age sword, but that didn't mean they didn't have a reason. He turned his attention back to his guest.
What happened after Amy charged the other vehicle?
Anderson glanced away, unable, or perhaps just unwilling, to meet Beresford's gaze. A long moment passed.
She killed them.
How?
She stabbed them, I think.
Remembering the massive puncture wound he'd seen on one of the bodies they'd found in the roadside ditch, Beresford wasn't all that surprised to hear it.
Did you see her actually kill them?
This time, the priest shook his head.
No, it happened so fast that I was still in my car for most of it. By the time I got out, the men were dead and she was staring at them through the open door of their car.
Beresford sat back and considered things for a moment. The way he saw it, there were two possible scenarios. One, Creed witnessed the massacre at the dig site, escaped the killers somehow, and was now running for her life. Or two, she had been working with the killers, had double-crossed them at the last minute, and was now running for her life with whatever it was she had stolen from them. A sword, perhaps? If Creed was on the run from those who'd murdered her colleagues, why hadn't she contacted the police? Half a day had passed since the confrontation on the highway. There'd certainly been ample time for her to get to a phone and report what happened to the authorities, and yet she'd chosen not to. That made it seem like she was intentionally avoiding the police, which lent some credence to the second scenario. Yet nothing he'd read in the thin file they'd managed to put together on Creed gave any indication that she was involved in illegal activities of any kind. In fact, On more than one occasion, she'd personally disrupted the activities of international artifact smugglers and black marketeers. It just wasn't adding up.
Did she threaten you at all, Father?
No.
Even after you found her with the two dead men?
No, not even then. No, I have to admit that I didn't wait around for an explanation either. Seeing her with that sword in hand, I decided discretion was the better part of valor and got myself and my car out of there as quickly as possible.
And she didn't try to stop you?
He shook his head.
Now that makes things a bit more interesting.
Given the file and the fact that she hadn't sought to silence Anderson, Beresford was beginning to think that perhaps Anya Creed was on the side of the angels after all. He spent another 10 minutes with Anderson, but didn't get anything more of importance from him. He thanked him for coming in, reiterated that he'd done the right thing, and said that he'd be in touch. Already regretting giving Doug a free hand to talk to the police, Anya headed back to her hotel. The clerk barely gave her a glance as she crossed the lobby and climbed the stairs to her room. Once inside, she used the hotel's Wi-Fi service to log onto the internet. She'd had to put a deposit on the bed sheets when she'd rented the room, and the beat-up old color television on the dresser nearby was bolted down to keep it from being stolen. But the hotel's wireless service was better than at most airports.
It's time to learn more about this mysterious Torque.
Celtic jewelry had exploded in popularity over the past few years, and a simple Google search for Celtic Torque turned up more than 500,000 sites, the majority of them selling replicas of one type or another. Mixed throughout, however, were articles discussing the history, manufacturing methods, and significance of this type of jewelry. Anya spent several hours digging through them for anything that might help her in identifying the importance of this particular Torque. She discovered that one of the earliest images depicting Celtic gods and warriors wearing a torque around their necks could be found on the side of a silver cauldron from the 1st century, unearthed at Gundestrup in Denmark. While it was interesting reading, it was all general in nature, and not particularly helpful with identifying the one she had in her possession.
Well, let's try another path.
Anya turned her attention next to the carvings of the eagles that adorned the clasps on the torque. She knew that in many cultures, the eagle represented the sun, and by extension, the ruler or monarch of the age. The eagle was also the symbol of the Roman Empire, a rather ironic fact, given that the man who'd been wearing the torque had been buried with the remains of 4 sacrificed Roman prisoners. A bit more research told her that for the Celts, the eagle was traditionally seen as one of the oldest of creatures, ancient and wise. They were considered harbingers of good luck and success. A couple of hours of research, and that was all she could come up with.
There has to be a better way of doing this.
In the hope of getting even the smallest of leads, Anya posted messages to 2 of her favorite news groups, alt.archaeology and alt.archaeology.esoterica.
I'm looking for information regarding a black torque and any ties it might have to Celtic culture or mythology. Just about anything would be helpful at this point.
Signing it Curious Celt, she fired it off with a touch of the enter key. She knew that doing so brought with it a little bit of risk. Data mining tools such as Google Alerts made it easy for anyone to track conversations going on around the web, and if anyone was watching for mention of a black torque, her message would act like a big red flag, letting them know that someone else was interested in the same thing. But right now, she didn't have much choice. So far, she'd gotten exactly nowhere with her research, and the trail got colder with every hour that passed. Her back was stiff from sitting hunched over the laptop for hours, so she got up and paced around the room, trying to work out the kinks in her muscles. As she passed the television, she turned it on, wanting the sound of something other than silence in the quiet of her hotel room. To her surprise, a familiar voice came from the speakers.
I repeat, Anya Creed is alive and well. I spoke to her a few hours ago from her safe house in London.
Anya stared in horror at the screen, where Doug Morrell was holding a press conference in front of the cable station studios in New York. He stood in front of the big glass doors to the studio, with a gaggle of reporters gathered in front of him.
Did Miss Creed tell you who was responsible for the brutal attack?
Yes, Anya Creed told me who was responsible for the attack. However, I will not share that information at this time. This is still very much a police matter. But rest assured, Chasing History's Monsters will be airing an exclusive two-part special on its co-host's harrowing ordeal just as soon as we're able. We'll tell you everything, including exactly what role the bog mummies played in the deadly attack.
Anya clicked to the next channel.
What role the bog mummies played in the deadly attack. Airing an exclusive two-part special.
The press conference was being carried live, or nearly so, on just about every station, it seemed. Anya stared at Doug's smiling face and wanted nothing more than to reach through the television set and strangle him where he stood. If the killers saw the broadcast, and chances were that they would, they were going to think that Anya had either recognized them or uncovered their identities in the time since the attack. Doug had just painted a big red bullseye on her back. In fact, he'd practically told them where to find her as well.
Safe house in London? Why not just give out the address while you were at it, Doug? I'm gonna kill him!
Anya gave herself 15 minutes to calm down, which wasn't anywhere near long enough, and then used her cell phone to call him again.
It's me again.
Anya!
Are you out of your freaking mind?
You sound upset, Anya. Has something happened?
Has something happened?
Now that the killers know that you're onto them, they'll have to leave you alone. Taking a shot at you would only land them in more hot water. I pretty much single-handedly saved your life.
The only thing you've done is to convince them that killing me is the only choice they have left. I can't believe that you are this naive. If I'm dead, then there isn't a witness to testify. No witness, no case. No case, no conviction, and life sentence.
It took him a moment to realize the magnitude of his error.
Oh, jeez, Anya! I'm sorry! God, how could I have been so stupid? I just didn't stop to think.
Unfortunately, that was a problem he had all too often. Still, his intentions had been good, she knew.
Fine, Doug, fine. I'll deal with it. Just get me that information I need.
Of course, Anya. Call me in the morning, your time. I should have something by then.
Still irritated, Anya hung up the phone and tried to figure out just how much of a problem Doug's impromptu press conference was going to cause for her. The police were certainly going to want to talk to her now that Doug had made it clear that she'd been at the site during the attack. Of course, they'd have to find her first, and that wasn't going to be easy. London was a big place, and the hotel she was staying in was so far off the grid for even a quasi-celebrity like herself that no one would ever think to look there. If she kept her head low and didn't do anything outrageous that might call attention to herself, she should be good to go. Doug, on the other hand, was probably fending off phone calls from Scotland Yard that very moment.
Serves him right.
Anya focused her attention back on her research. A check of her email showed that she'd already received 3 messages in response to her newsgroup posting. The first was from lordofthesword@dungeons.net.
Sounds like a cool quest. I'm a 47th level fighter with bracers of glory. I'll offer you my services for 15% of the treasure. What do you say? I say get a life.
The next one, from CelticQueen@druidhome.com, was more to the point, but wasn't very helpful either.
Sounds like you've got your work cut out for you. I'm not an expert in Celtic culture or mythology by any means, but I've never heard of a black torque before. Most of the ones I've seen were made from gold or at least gold plate. You might check the legends associated with either Cuchulainn or Finn McCool. They're both Irish heroes who got around a lot, and there might be mention of your black torque in one of their adventures. Best of luck.
The third message showed some promise. It was from historybuff@oxfordarchives.edu, which she took to be a good sign.
Several years ago, I heard a presentation in Paris on mystical artifacts that appeared in various Celtic legends. I think the speaker's name was Deschamps. The talk focused mainly on weapons like the Gaebolg, Cuchulainn's spear, and the Cleve Saulish, the sword of Nuada, leader of the Tuatha De Danann. But he did mention a few other objects. If I remember correctly, one of them was a black necklace. I don't know if that's the necklace you are seeking, but it might be worth looking into. Last I'd heard, Deschamps was still working in Paris. Now that sounds more like what I'm looking for.
Anya did a quick Google search for a Professor Deschamps and came up empty. But there was a Dr. Henri Deschamps listed on the staff at the Natural History Museum in Paris. In the staff pages of the museum's website, she found a telephone number for him. She called, got an answering machine, and decided it was worth the risk to leave a message.
Hello, Dr. Deschamps. My name is Anya Creed, and I'd like to speak to you privately about a black torque that was recently unearthed in England. If you could call me at your convenience, that would be great.
Thinking of Paris made her think of her sometime mentor, Rue. She'd resisted calling him to this point, thinking she could puzzle it out on her own. But given the circles he moved in, he might just know Dr. Deschamps, and that was too good an opportunity for her to pass up. Besides, she had to admit she kind of missed him. She'd never say that to his face, but it was true nonetheless. She'd first met him in the Cévennes Mountains of France. She'd been hunting the Beast of Gévaudan, a legendary creature, some said a werewolf, that had supposedly terrorized the region in the late 1700s. Rue had been looking for the final pieces of a sword that had shattered almost 600 years before, a sword once borne by Joan of Arc herself. It was only much later, when the sword was reborn in her hand, that Anya learned that Rue had been there on that fateful day, when the sword had been shattered and a young woman martyred for her faith. The breaking of the sword and the death of its bearer had caused Rue and his young charge, Garin Braden, to be pushed outside the boundaries of time. For years, Rue had sought the pieces of the sword, believing that he would be released from his fate once the sword had been forged anew. His one-time protégé, Garin, on the other hand, opposed his efforts, not wanting his long life to be cut short by the machinations of the remorseful old fool he'd once treated as his father. Rue was an irascible, ill-tempered, egotistical, pompous ass who tried to tell her what to do all the time. But to Anya, who'd grown up in an orphanage, he was the closest thing she'd ever had to a family. And when you needed help, that's who you turned to. Family. The phone rang several times before Rue's voicemail clicked in.
Rue, I'm fine in case you've worried from the news reports, but I would like you to call. Talk to you soon.
With her thoughts still wrapped up in the stupid press conference Doug had held, she didn't realize that she'd forgotten to give Rue her new number. With Rue unavailable, Anya considered calling Garin, but finally dismissed the idea. Garin had a way of confronting situations head-on, which was all well and good when you wanted to make a statement, but this situation called for a bit more finesse for the time being. She'd hold off for now. She could always give him a call if things began to spin out of control.
I repeat, Anya Creed is alive and well.
In another part of London, miles away from where Anya was hiding out, the head of the Red Hand Defenders and his senior captain were watching Doug Morrell's press conference.
I thought you said you'd taken care of her.
I did, Mr. Shaw. Apparently I was mistaken.
Trevor Jackson waited for his employer to explode in anger, but the other man somehow managed to retain control. This was clearly a first, and it made Jackson nervous.
Could she be responsible for the deaths of our two operatives?
His subordinate gave it some thought. The two men in question had been found dead at the side of the road some distance from the dig site, but that didn't rule out the possibility. After all, if this Creed woman had survived being shot and then managed to cut cross-country after escaping from the bog, she could easily have crossed the motorway in that area. Jackson kept his thoughts to himself, however.
Yes, it's possible. We're still looking to locate their missing car, but if Morrell is telling the truth, and she's indeed here in London, it's quite possible she simply stole the vehicle after killing her men and then used it to make the journey here.
She must have the torque.
It's certainly possible, yes.
As much as he hated to admit it, Jackson thought his employer could be right. She must have hidden the torque before attacking his people that night and then retrieved it when she escaped from the bog. The thought got his anger up. How she'd managed to survive that gunshot to the skull, never mind the cloying grip of the bog afterward, was something he intended to ask her. Right after, he beat her mercilessly for putting him in this position in the first place.
We still have people in New York, yes?
Of course.
Put them on Morell. I want his phone tapped, his house and office watched. If he's telling the truth, this Creed woman has been in touch and will likely reach out to him again. When she does, I want to know about it.
I'm on it.
Shaw turned to face him.
The auction ends in 36 hours. You have that long to get me that torque. No excuses and no more screw-ups.
At just after 4 that afternoon, a man got off the elevator outside the Chasing History's Monsters production office in New York City. He was dressed in dark pants and a white shirt, with a tie that was intentionally tied an inch shorter than it should be. His hair, a little longer than the average corporate wage slave's, was slicked back without much regard for style or flair. He wore an unattractive pair of glasses and an ID badge, showing his picture and the name Newman in large letters, was hanging from a lanyard around his neck. In his left hand, he carried a scuffed leather computer bag that sprouted a few inches of Ethernet cable and the end of a flow meter out of its partially opened mouth. The operative had been hired by a local fixer, who in turn had been contacted by an acquaintance overseas, who himself was a secondary cutout from the man who actually wanted the work done. The operative liked it that way. If things went sour, and he ended up across the table from a couple of cops looking to send him up the river for a few years, he really didn't know squat, which meant that there was only so much crap that could hang around his neck and make stick. He was always the type to face things head on. None of this sneaking about in the middle of the night garbage for him. No, sir. At night, you had to deal with alarm systems and security cameras, never mind the guards themselves. You couldn't finesse technology, at least not easily, the operative told himself. But people you could finesse. Like the office receptionist who passed him in with nothing but a glance, grateful the latest geek from IT didn't hit on her. Once past the reception area, the operative wandered through the warren of cubicles until he found the office he wanted. His target, a producer named Doug Morell, looked up from behind his desk.
Yeah.
The operative held his ID card away from his chest for Morell to see, and then let it flop back again.
IT department, I'm supposed to check the phone jacks as prep for the fiber optic install next week.
How long are we talking about?
10, maybe 15 minutes. I gotta pull out the wall plate, test the circuits, make sure you got room for when they lay the dual cabling next week.
Morell's eyes were already glazing over.
Yeah, oh, okay, fine, do your thing. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee, and I'll be back in 15 minutes.
Sure, man, whatever.
He dumped his bag on the small conference table near the desk, pretending to dig through it for the right set of tools. By the time he looked up again, Morell was nowhere in sight.
Works every time.
He leaned over the desk and took a look at the handset for Morell's telephone. It was like a thousand others he'd seen in offices the world over, two pieces of dark-colored plastic glued together around the internal components. Easy to produce and cheap as hell, too. The operative dug around inside his bag for a moment, until at last he found the receiver he was looking for. It was a near-perfect copy of the one attached to Morell's phone, with one major exception. This one had a listening device already installed in the midst of the internal wiring. Rather than trying to crack open Morell's handset and implant a bug before he got back from his coffee jaunt, all the operative had to do was calmly unplug the existing handset, toss it in the bag, and plug in the new one in its place. A moment after arriving, the job was done. To keep up appearances, the operative actually removed the phone jack's wall plate and pulled the wires out of the recessed box behind the plate, pretending to be sorting through the various pieces.
No, I'm walking back in the office now. I'll check the calendar and see where I can fit it in. Yeah, bye.
By the time the young producer came back through the office door, the operative had just finished screwing the wall plate back into place.
All set?
All set.
It took him less than 10 minutes to exit the building and disappear into the crowd outside, with no one the wiser. When he was a few blocks away, he pulled out his cell phone and dialed his partner's number.
You're good.
Even if Morell left the office that very instant, his partner would still have plenty of time to get inside the man's apartment, bug the telephones there, and get out again long before Morell could make the trip over to the other borough. Everything rolled according to plan.
Just how I like it.
Anya waited as long as she could stand it the next morning, then called Doug.
What did you find out about the torque?
Huh? Find out about the what? What time is it?
Focus, Doug. You were going to get me information on the torque, remember?
Yeah. The torque. Right. Okay. Hang...
Doug, are you all right?
It's still dark outside, Anya!
Anya smiled, glancing at the clock on the desk beside her. It was 9 o'clock a.m., London time, just about 4 o'clock a.m. in New York. Revenge can be so sweet.
I know it is, Doug. After all, the sun still hasn't come up on your side of the world, but over here it's getting busy and I need to get going. So quit whining about the hour and tell me about the torque.
Fine, but don't think I won't remember this.
Oh, I'm shaking in my boots. The torque, Doug.
The research team struck out. They tried the usual sources, but didn't find anything to match what you were looking for. The best they could come up with was to recommend that you talk to a guy by the name of Deschamps at the National History Museum in Paris. He's supposed to be the resident expert in Celtic culture, now that your friend Craig has been, has passed away.
Recalling Craig's murder took some of the wind out of her sails, but at least she had some confirmation that Deschamps was someone worth talking to. So that was good news.
And the tattoo?
Well, the research team did dig up some information on that, but I'm not sure you're going to like it. And I have to say, I don't see how it's even relevant.
Tell me.
Nobody should have to get up and function at 4 a.m. Okay, let me find this stuff. Okay, the Red Hand of Ulster, also sometimes known as the Red Hand of O'Neill, or the Red Hand of Ireland, is an Irish Gaelic symbol that originated in pagan times. It's often associated with a legendary figure known by several different names, including Labraid of the Red Hand.
Go on.
There are two stories associated with the symbol. The first states that, at one time, the Kingdom of Ulster had no rightful heir, so a boat race was staged to see who would be king. The first man to lay his hand on the soil of Ulster would take the prize. One competitor, a man from the O'Neill clan, loved Ulster so much that he couldn't let the crown go to anyone else. When it looked like one of the other competitors might win the race, this man cut off his hand and threw it ahead of the other boat. Since his severed hand reached the soil of Ulster before anyone else's, the O'Neill kinsman was named king.
Gross. What's the other story?
Two giants were engaged in battle on the shores of Ulster. One of them cut off his hand and left a bloody handprint on the rocks along the shore. The men of Ulster took it as their standard to show how powerful they were.
Anya frowned. What did any of that have to do with Big Red or the Black Torque?
Is that it?
Yeah, except for the terrorist thing. Personally, I
think... Wait, what terrorist thing?
Didn't I tell you about that already?
The urge to hit something reared its head.
No, Doug, you didn't mention that.
Oh, okay. Then, hang on a sec. The Red Hand, specifically a tattoo of a red hand, has also been used in recent years as a symbol of the Red Hand Defenders, or RHD. A loyalist paramilitary terrorist group linked to the Ulster Volunteer Force of Northern Ireland.
Anya stared at the wall of her hotel room, lost in thought. What on earth would Irish terrorists want with a 2,000-year-old necklace? It just didn't make much sense from a practical standpoint.
I wouldn't concentrate on that if I were you, though. Even the police seem to think that the RHD doesn't really exist. There's a quote here from a senior Irish official. The title Red Hand Defenders has been used to claim murders on all sides and is not thought to represent any real organization. I think they'd be the ones to know.
Could be.
Even as she answered, Anya had a feeling they were finally on the right track. After all, if she'd run into just one gunman wearing the tattoo, she wouldn't have given it a second thought. But the two men in the Mercedes bore the same mark. That made it more than a coincidence for her. There was something there. She was just going to have to figure out what.
All right, Doug. Thanks.
That's all I get? You woke me up at old dark 30 and all...
Serves you right.
Three blocks away from Doug Morrell's apartment, two men sat in the back of a van parked at the side of the street. They'd been there since early the night before, and the air inside the vehicle was thick with the smell of body odor, stale coffee, the various cartons of takeout food piled in one corner, blending with the fumes the coffee and food led to after they'd passed through the occupants' gastrointestinal systems. As soon as Doug picked up the phone in his apartment, the two men in the van went to work. Sophisticated computer equipment began the process of tracking where the call had originated. One man listened to the actual conversation, looking for clues to the caller's location and what was said, just in case the call didn't last long enough for the trace to go through. From the time references, it was clear that the caller was somewhere other than North America, and the listener made a note to that effect on the yellow legal pad in front of him. As he worked to glean something from the conversation itself, his partner monitored the computer tracking program. It pinpointed the continent first, which turned out to be Europe, and then a few minutes later, narrowed that down to the country, England. The man and the woman on the phone continued speaking, and so the computer continued working, pinpointing the city the call was coming from as London. Finally, in the very last few seconds of the conversation, the computer was able to pinpoint the location right down to the building the call originated from. By the time Anya hung up the phone, not only did the two men in the van know she was calling from a hotel on the outskirts of London, but they even knew the floor she was calling from.
You got the same?
The two men compared notes, agreed that they had reliable data to pass on to their employer. They sent a copy of the trace, as well as a written report of the call, to their employer. Though neither one of them said it aloud, they were both thinking how funny it was that the woman their employer was searching for was right under his nose. Half an hour later, Anya sat in a shadowy pub a few blocks from her hotel, staring at the greasy menu and trying to decide if she really trusted a place like this to cook something that wouldn't give her food poisoning. Anya glanced at the caller ID.
Museum d'Histoire Naturelle. Hello?
Is this Anya Creed?
Yes, it is. Thank you for getting back to me so quickly, Dr. Deschamps.
How did you... Caller ID, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I don't know anyone else at the Paris Museum of Natural History, so...
quite right. Silly me. Now, what can I do for you, Miss Creed? Your voicemail mentioned something about a black talk?
Relieved at both his receptiveness, as well as the fact that he apparently hadn't heard the authorities were looking for her in conjunction with the events at the dig site in Arkholm, Anya explained that she'd recently been involved in an excavation that uncovered an unusual specimen of torque that seemed to have come from the early Iron Age, and that she was looking for any information relative to such a find that might help her pinpoint its origin and purpose. It wasn't exactly why she wanted the information, but it was close enough to the truth that he shouldn't question her motives.
Well, I'd certainly be willing to see what I could do to help you. Are you here in Paris? Could you make a 3 o'clock appointment tomorrow? I've had a cancellation and could fit you in then.
Three tomorrow would be fine, Dr. Deschamps. Thank you.
I'll have a security pass waiting for you at the museum's information desk.
When she hung up the phone, Anya felt hopeful for the first time in days. She had several leads now, and that, more than anything else, told her she was making headway. She would get to the bottom of this.